You better come on in my kitchen. There's far to be raining out door.
Come over here, kid. Where's up? You never know, you might have to cook for 20 guys someday. You see, you start out with a little bit of oil. You fry some garlic. Then you throw in some tomatoes, tomato paste, you fry it, you make sure it doesn't stick. You gotta do a boil, you shove in all your sausage and your meatballs. Huh? And a little bit of wine. A little bit of sugar.
Delicious.
And that's my trick.
When the moon hits your eye like a bigger pizza pie, that's amore.
Enough. I'm so sick and tired of hearing you people talk about food, food, food. That's all anybody ever talks about is prosciutto, cheese, and fava beans. I'm drowning here.
Jesus Christ, take it easy.
We're not even engaged yet.
When you're married, you'll understand the importance of fresh produce.
Potatoes, yeah.
I eat with gusto, damn your bet, my country, tis of thee. I eat for social progress, I eat for victory.
Delicious.
Stay hungry, stay hungry, stay hungry.
You want some more?
Good evening and welcome to Mouthful, the Wine Country's most delicious hour. It's Michelle and Jordan. Merry Christmas. Happy New Year. It is the last show of 2009. Thanks for tuning in. I hope you've had a good weekend. I'm really excited about tonight's show. But before I introduce the topic and our very special guest, I want to tell you a couple of different things. If you're looking for something to do in Sonoma County, for New Year's, Mouthful has two recommendations for you. One, Safari West is having their annual party. Safari West is always just a great place to be. When the sun goes down, some of the animals wake up. There's the most wonderful calls and screeches and shouts. So they're having a party. You can find out all about it at safariwest.com. So check it out. And as it turns out, I think I may end up being there myself. Another thing going on up in Geyserville, it is the last night of Santi, the restaurant. Gosh, I think it's been there about 10 years now. It will be closing its current location there on the main street of Geyserville, and it will be reopening right there near Traverso's new location at Stagecoach and Fountain Grove. So if you want to get in on the very last night of Santi, also known as Taverna Santi, you might want to check that out. It's going to be an all-you-can-eat buffet, dancing, toast at midnight. Again, you can go to their website as well. So if you can't find it, just Google Santi plus Geyserville and you will be there. Mouthful has lots of plans for the new year, and I'm going to invite you to participate in one of those new plans. We introduced the show with a sound collage. I worked for a long time taking notes on what movie clips and songs I wanted to have in there. So now I'm gathering new ideas. If you have an idea that you think would work in Mouthful's opening sound collage, you can send that to me at catsmilk@sonic.net. You can also, if you're on Facebook, you can become a fan of Mouthful. Just type in Mouthful, the Wine Country's Most Delicious Hour, and you can post your suggestion there on the fan page. I hope to have it done within the first month or so of the new year. So that's the announcements. And now on to a show that I just can't believe I'm lucky enough to get to do it. Peanuts Cooks is an exhibit at the Charles Schultz Museum and Research Center in Santa Rosa, a wonderful location. It's just to the west of the Redwood Empire Ice Arena, and it's on the other side is the Snoopy Gallery and Gift Shop. I spent much of today there seeing the show. I had lunch at the Warm Puppy Cafe. Yes, I had root beer. You have to have root beer there. And it's just so amazing to look at the remarkable contribution that Charles Schultz made, not just to Sonoma County and Santa Rosa, but really to the world. With just that single line drawing, he evoked, gosh, so many human emotions went straight to our hearts. And I remember when I was really young, I was so in love with Snoopy. And truth be told, I still am. When I first moved to Sebastopol, I lived right around the corner from Coffee Grounds. And it was just all too much. I had to, like, no, I can't believe this. I just ignored it. But now I get to welcome Gene Schultz here, and we get to talk about Peanuts Cooks, which is on view until February 15th, 2010. Gene, welcome to Mouthful. I'm so happy you could make it.
Thank you. It's wonderful to be here on Mouthful, and I thank you for having me. And it's wonderful comment about the museum. Of course, I love it. I put my heart into it, and I'm glad that you enjoyed spending a lot of your day there.
Well, I didn't tell them I was there for any special reason. I just went with my grandson, Lucas. And one of the things that I loved so much about it is the staff is so warm. I had a couple of quick questions, and it's like, oh, I'll go find that out for you. It was just a warmth permeated everything. And of course, all of the cartoon panels, there's a warmth that comes out, you know, from them as well. And plus, when you walk in right now at this time of year, you walk in and there in the entryway is the Charlie Brown Christmas tree.
That's right. People can take their pictures there.
There were a lot of people taking their pictures with the tree. And of course, that's the spindly little tree with one red bulb and a little blue blanket wrapped around it at the bottom. Yeah.
Part of what I wanted when we built the museum, and Sparky was alive, my husband was alive when we planned it, but not when we actually built it.
It opened in sometime in 2001?
It opened in 2002.
Oh, 2002. Okay.
And it took about 2 years to build. Anyway, I wanted it to be home-like. And part of home-like is if you walk in the door, someone says, well, nice to see you, and how was your trip getting here? Mm-hmm. And we don't quite do that, but that's what I envisioned that the museum would be like, that we would welcome each person personally. You know, we're glad you're here. You're our guests. Come on in.
Yeah.
So I'm glad it worked for you today.
It definitely did. And it's two levels. And one thing that surprised me, and I'm sort of embarrassed, but I'm just going to go ahead and tell this about myself. I had somehow missed the Christo connection.
Well, maybe you're not old enough.
I was here, actually.
Oh.
And what I remember about Christo and his running fence, it was the first time I saw a traffic jam on 101,
yes.
That was not related to
the pumpkin patch.
Right,
and now,
yes.
Now the pumpkin patch.
But Christo's running fence, and they're starting to walk up, and this sort of overhang from the second floor, you see Snoopy's doghouse wrapped by Christo. And of course, you know, we saw the cartoon, and of course, I remember that.
Well, like everything, there's a story attached, and I don't want to make the story too long, but Christo's attorney happened to be Sparky's attorney.
Oh.
And so one day I called Sparky and said, there's this crazy project, and Ed's going to be talking to the Board of Supervisors. We have to go down and hear it. So we rushed down to the Board of Supervisors, couldn't get in to sit down, but stood in the doorway.
This was about 1973, I think, wasn't it?
It was in the very beginning.
Right.
So it was 73, 74. Yeah. And we could barely see what was going on, but we stayed there for, I don't know, 40 minutes or something, listened to Ed talk about it and a few other people testify to the Board of Supervisors, and then went away, and I still think we're scratching our heads. But we met Christo a number of times. So by the time the fence was built, I think Sparky felt as though he knew Christo or knew what he was about.
Mm-hmm.
And so then the comic strip, you know, Snoopy saying, I wonder what he'll wrap next. And of course, it's his doghouse.
Yes. And so, then it was in 2003 that
They visited the museum, and and I asked him if he would wrap Snoopy, and he said, oh, I couldn't do that. And he's quite right. He said the children wouldn't like that. And I thought, that's very interesting. How stupid of me.
But that's a really intuitive response on
his
part.
Yes, it is. It came right out. And then he said, but I could wrap a doghouse. So anyway, it's a lot of fun, and I find myself explaining it all to people.
Really?
Because...
So most people don't really
Most people
know.
Don't know... Uh-huh. Most people don't know about Christo these days. A lot of people. I mean, if you weren't here and if you're too young. And
yeah, that's true.
So all I can say is, well, you remember the gates in New York? Well, the same
magnificent,
person.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's right there on the edge of the Peanuts Cooks.
Yes, yeah.
How did Peanuts Cooks, how did the exhibition come about?
Well, all of our exhibitions come about because our great brains in the museum, the board, mostly our exhibit committee, our curator and so forth, talk about what we can do. And museums, as you know, plan their exhibitions out 2 years. Mm-hmm. And when we first started, I thought, oh, we're scrambling. How are we ever going to plan 2 years out? But a few years ago, we hired Jane O'Kane, who is an experienced curator, and she knows that she's like a researcher. She goes through everything, finds subjects that she thinks have enough strips to have body to them and story, and then we all get together, and she actually asks for opinions and throws out a few of her own. But when they said Peanuts Cooks, it's hard for me to imagine that there's enough to put an exhibition around. But they're more knowledgeable and creative and imaginative than I would be. So they see, they just pull all the pieces together. Mm-hmm. So as you can see, it's not only comic strips. It's some product that people did for cooking. It's some books that have
there were recipe, a number of recipe
books.
One in Japanese.
Yes. So so they pull all those things together, and that's Jane's research function. And then the other people who have the material, the archivist, checks the what we have that might do this. One of the things, just one technicality, that gallery where you saw those, most of those aren't original strips. Most of those will be reproductions of strips. But the gallery downstairs, what I call the heart and soul of the museum, is all original strips.
All originals.
But upstairs in the Peanuts Cooks, we might not have enough original strips to do that. So if you noticed, we blew things up.
Sure, and, absolutely.
Yeah, so we can make it more colorful, make it a little more eye-appealing, I suppose, you could say.
But I think one of the things that you do in that show is you bring up so many of the iconic images. Snoopy with his dinner dish. And one of the things I was reading today, I think it must have been up there, was it talked about how, and should I call him Charles? Should I call him Sparky?
Oh, call him Sparky.
Okay, Sparky. And we should say that was a nickname from the time he was like 2 months old or something.
That's right, yes.
Yeah. He developed this whole fantasy life for Snoopy that had to do with the dinner hour when Charlie Brown was going to feed him and what he could do to get it a little sooner, that sort of thing. So that was a theme that threaded itself through the decades of Peanuts.
I know. Well, think about having to draw. You know, there is that one statement in the museum, a cartoonist is someone who draws the same thing day after day without repeating himself.
Yes.
So, you know, dogs and their dinner, they get their dinner once or twice a day. So it lends itself to a lot of ideas, but you also have to use those ideas because you have to come up with a strip every day.
Yeah. And plus, there's that one idea is so true. I haven't owned a dog in many, many years, but I've been around enough of them. They know when dinner's approaching and they just sit there with those huge eyes looking at you like, well, are you going to feed me?
I know. They all have different approaches. It's either bouncing up and down and looking cute or pawing you or nuzzling you or whatever. And of course, Snoopy being Snoopy can do all sorts of things, including sort of look at Charlie Brown as if to say, what's the matter with you? This isn't a really, you call this a dinner?
Yes. You know? And in one of the cartoons,
where's my turkey? And this is dog food.
Yes. It's impossible to eat dog food when your stomach is all set for shrimp Louie. That is one of my favorites. And then there's a recipe for shrimp Louie. It's great. And then one of the classic things that I remember Charlie Brown saying is, when you're real lonely, the peanut butter sticks to the roof of your mouth. So there were lots of things. And we're going to talk in a little bit about the 7-minute frosting, whose 7-minute frosting it was and why it became so famous. And of course, they all loved Angel Food Cake, which I do as well. But what we're going to do now is we're going to take a little musical break. We'll be very familiar to you. And when we come back, we're going to have Laura Shapiro, author of many books, including Perfection Salad and her book about dinner in the 1950s, Something from the Oven. I thought she would be the perfect person to weigh in on Peanuts Cooks. Yep, you're listening to Mouthful. My guest in the studio, Gene Schultz. We are talking about Peanuts Cooks, now on view at the Charles M. Schultz Museum in Santa Rosa. And if technology has served us well, we also have author Laura Shapiro on the phone with us. Laura?
Hi.
Hi, how are you this evening?
Great, thank you.
Thank you so much for joining us. I know it's late there in New York.
Well, it's good to talk to you.
Well, let me introduce you to Gene here. Gene, meet Laura Shapiro.
Hi,
hello,
Gene.
Laura.
Hi.
I've been telling her all about Perfection Salad, one of my favorite books on food in the world ever.
Thank you.
And also, I love Something from the Oven as well. So I sent you that big package of Snoopy or Peanuts cartoons about food.
Yes, I've been poring over them.
A lot of them are from the 1960s, some of them from the 1950s, I believe. Could you tell that in the way he evoked food? Did it speak to you of a certain time?
You know, the recipes, what I really focused on were the recipes from the 67 book, and these were really fascinating. It really tells you something about the 60s. It's as if they were trying to shake off the 50s, but they didn't know quite where to go. There's a kind of timeless quality about these recipes. There are things there that that we're certainly still eating. And then there are things that, you know, if somebody showed them to us, we'd run screaming into the next room. So it's a wonderful kind of ricochet feeling that you get when you look at some of these.
Angel Food Cake seems to have made a comeback.
I hope so.
Yes.
In fact, why did it ever go away?
I have no idea. It never went away in my world.
Yes.
But I've started to see it on restaurant menus in the last, the last 2 years or so. I'll see just Angel Food Cake neat, or Angel Food Cake with a little something on the side, and they'll leave it off for me because I like just Angel Food Cake.
You want those angels to be purely angelic.
Absolutely. We should talk about Sparky's Angel Food Cake because of his 7-minute frosting. It was, if I have it right, it was
Harriet Crosland.
Crosland, okay. And she worked in the office?
No. She was a visitor to the Ice Arena.
Oh.
I believe she was in the Symphony League, and the Symphony and the Ice Arena may have done something together in the day. Well, I know the Symphony played in the Ice Arena once. But I think that Harriet started bringing Angel Food Cake with her special 7-minute frosting to Sparky, and he enjoyed that. So, as he said, he had to use everything in his life in the comic strip, so he did.
And then he also named one of Woodstock's friends,
Harriet.
One of the little birds, Harriet.
Yes, that's right. That's right. And then Harriet brought her cake with her 7-minute frosting. So,
well, it's good to see it get this touch of immortality. And then to think that it's actually also still with us in the real world, that is a great reward.
So, Laura, one of the things I was hoping you could talk about is a little bit about what happened in the 50s that so changed American eating and dinner.
Well, in the 50s, and as I say, these recipes are kind of odd, a little bit removed from that because they're, to me, they bespeak a much kind of wider view of American cooking. But in the 50s, what happened was that you had the food industry coming out full force to convince American women that opening boxes counted as cooking. And they had to do that because they had just come out of World War II, and the factories were all up and running to produce all of this packaged food, and that's what they knew how to turn out, and they had to get Americans to eat it. And it wasn't all that good at the time, and people were not that interested. And the real thing was that women didn't think of it as cooking. I mean, they understood what food was, and they knew how to cook, and they knew that opening two boxes and a jar and mixing it together and squirting Ready Whip on top didn't count. They just knew that. So you had this immense clash between ordinary home cooks and the food industry, and the food industry went at it with advertising and taking over newspaper food sections and really every weapon that they had. And in the end, they made tremendous inroads into the American diet, but they didn't quite triumph. Cooking survived, but that's why we are still making and eating real angel food cake today, because, you know, it didn't quite go away. Women still wanted to cook, and that's kind of the great victory that I tried to put in the book, and that I think we survive today. So look at these recipes from the Snoopy recipes. You have a homemade pizza. Well, you know what? You don't have to make a pizza. Even in 1967, you didn't have to make a pizza. You could buy one, but the ones you make at home are going to be better. And here it is in the 60s, and we're still doing it today. Or this ice cream igloo, which I think sounds wonderful.
Oh, I know. I love this one.
So this is real food. So that in the 60s, you're coming out of the 50s, you're coming out of the great era of packaged foods, when packaged foods made their stand and marched to the center of the plate, but they didn't quite get there, and real cooking survived. And that's what you're seeing in some of these. Some of it I would think we can do without. The honey bread with the buttermilk, I am not convinced by that recipe.
Yeah, and I'm not entirely convinced about the fruit salad with marshmallows either.
I was going to say the marshmallows and whipped cream and canned cherries, and that was the one I always point out to people if I happen to be walking through the exhibit with them.
Yes, well, that is a classic American event that really packs a wallop. But, you know, you can't even really identify that with the 50s as much as with the early 1900s, when canned and packaged foods began their
march. When you first started seeing them.
Yes. So,
oh, interesting.
So,
you know, Laura, I have a friend who was in Europe during the war. His father, he was an army brat, and he used to tell us when we were traveling in France that the French came over to America and thought our food was awful, but he said the best food in America was in the homes, not in restaurants, back in the 50s.
Absolutely,
and
yes.
That sounds like what you're saying, too.
Absolutely, because home cooking definitely survived then. People had not lost the skill. And for restaurants, there were certainly some interesting restaurants. I would say New York, Chicago, Los Angeles, San Francisco, and, of course, New Orleans. You would have found some restaurants, but the vast sweep of the country, it was not a great eating-out era in the 50s. But home cooking, absolutely, it was alive and well. One reason for that is that people hadn't lost it. You know, cooking is generational. You grow up in a kitchen and you see what it's about and you get used to doing it, and then you grow up and you do it. But if you break the chain, it's very hard to get it back again. In the 50s, the mothers were cooking. The daughters were going to Girl Scouts and taking piano lessons, and they were just doing less and less of that growing up in the kitchen. And so the chain started to get broken. So your friend's father is right. The home cooking was still alive and well in the 50s, but 60s, 70s, and 80s, it would then be dwindling, not disappearing, I maintain strongly, but definitely dwindling.
What do you think is happening now with that?
You know, I think in some ways it's coming back with a roar. You see so many cooking schools out there and cooking classes. Mm-hmm. There are, thanks to the internet and to a billion cookbooks and all kinds of access to recipes, simple recipes, 3-ingredient recipes, 5-ingredient recipes, and recipes that are are very simple, but made with very fresh ingredients and real food. It's easier to cook now than it ever has been in the history of probably any country. So that you barely need to know how to boil water because it'll come out hot from the faucet. You can cook, and I think people are figuring that out. And thanks to the recession, more and more people are realizing that that it makes sense to make a simple meal at home rather than constantly calling out for pizzas.
Yeah, I think so too. And it seems to me that there's just almost this, I don't know, we could call this atavistic need or longing to cook.
Yes, and I think that that's what food television is all about, that people are gathering around to watch cooking on television because they're hungry to cook. And maybe it just hasn't occurred to them that they can
cook. They can, right.
So they're watching it on that, which is why I suspect also that this the Schultz exhibit is probably doing very well, because we love to look back at people cooking and eating and thinking about food. I suspect walking through this show makes people feel very good.
Yeah, it makes you feel hungry. It makes you remember. I mean, up above one of the walls of... I think there's three or four panels. Up above is a shelf, and there are cookie jars, candy containers, lunch boxes, thermoses. And you look up, and you see your grandmother's kitchen or your mother's kitchen or the kitchen at someone's house. And then there's also a display cabinet, and it has two of the images that most struck me. There was Snoopy face down, arms spread out on top of a hamburger. And then there was another one, a ceramic hot dog, Snoopy on his back, also with his arms spread out. And it was just a look of such indulgent pleasure. And then there, of course, were all of the ones of Snoopy as chef, Snoopy with a chef's hat, Snoopy with
spatulas
and things for using on a grill, all that sort of thing.
Well, and that's exactly what you see in these written-out recipes, too, of course, this sense of the American classic. I mean, good or bad, they're all American classics in their way. A low-calorie pumpkin dessert, I mean, you may not want to eat it, but it's an American classic.
I have to tell you what Sparky's favorite dinner was. I think I might have been one of those people, although I did cook in the 50s when I was at home, but because my mother worked. But, it was pretty basic pot roast and fried chicken or something like that.
Sounds good
but,
to me.
But Sparky's favorite thing when I got, when we got married was, which was early 70s, was tuna casserole. So I was off the hook for fancy cooking.
Well, you know, none other than Julia Child once published a recipe for tuna casserole, so you're in excellent company there.
Yes.
Laura, before we let you go, are you working on anything now?
I am. I'm working on a book in which I'm writing some biographical essays about women looking at their lives through food. I've been thinking that that we all have a food story. You don't have to write a cookbook or be a chef to have a food story. We all relate to food. So I'm thinking about biography and culinary history and how they can be put together. So it mostly means going to the library and reading. That's as far as I've gotten, but which is a wonderful way to start any project as far as I'm concerned.
It sounds like something I definitely look forward to. Any idea when we might actually see it?
Oh, it's so early.
So early.
Probably years to come. I just hope there still will be books published on paper by the time I get this out.
You know, I feel that exact same way about books on paper as I do about cooking.
Yes.
I don't think we will ever all go to bed and curl up at night with a Kindle.
No.
You know, my eyes get really tired when I read on a screen.
That's right.
And the smell, the feel of paper, that's not ever going to go away. So whenever you get it done, I will be the first in line to buy a copy.
Good, and you can read it while you're eating a peanut butter, bacon, and pickle sandwich.
There you go. Bacon and pickles, two of my favorite things. Well, Laura, I'm going to let you go. Thank you so much. Really generous to talk to us on a cold night in New York.
Thanks very much. This was fun.
Okay, talk to you again soon.
Okay,
good night.
Bye-bye.
Yes, back to Mouthful. It's Michelle. We are talking about Peanuts cooks. Peanuts and all the gang. Oh, Snoopy. Lucy, Linus. There was one that I saw, you know, a cranky old Lucy. I think she was griping at Linus for being too loud. I think he was eating cereal too loud. It went on. And he's putting butter on his toast. He's there. Oh, am I buttering too loud for you?
That is straight out of their family.
Really? I laughed out loud with that.
Yep, that's straight out of their family. Amy, the second daughter, and I don't know how old she was. I'm guessing 5 or something. And she was just fussing about at the table. And Sparky probably criticized her for being so noisy. So then she came back with that.
With that, really?
Very good. And Sparky used to always say, people would say, well, did your children give you ideas? And he would say, well, about 16 in 50 years, and that's not very much. But in reality, of course, he gleaned things from them. But that was a direct, he took that directly from his daughter.
Well, it was a wonderful moment for me today.
Yeah.
Now, you have a cake mix story.
Well, my cake mix story, and it feeds in beautifully to what Laura was saying. We had a French interviewer who came to visit us, and she had come to visit Sparky once before. And the second time she came, we spent a little more time with her because now she was a friend and known to us. And she wanted me to take her to a supermarket. And I thought, well, they don't have supermarkets in France, I guess. It's probably 1974. And so she wants to go. And we went to the supermarket, and she was very eccentric in some ways. And she wanted me to buy a cake mix. And I bought the cake mix. And I thought maybe she wanted to take it home to France. But when we got back to my house, she wanted me to make it. So I made the cake mix. And then I thought she would want to eat it. She didn't want to eat it. She just really wanted to see.
She wanted to see what would
happen.
Wanted
to see the whole process.
Now, do you remember what kind of cake mix it was?
Probably just a white cake mix, but I don't know for sure. And I don't know if she picked the cake mix or if I did, but I just thought it was so odd that somebody all along the way, I thought she wanted to eat it.
Sure.
I thought she was curious about how it would taste.
You would think that if she was curious about the process, you would expect that the curiosity would run all the way through.
But no, she wasn't interested in eating.
How odd.
I thought it was very odd. But I love it. I mean, it just shows vive la différence, you know.
Yeah. So how many languages? Do we even know how many languages
Snoopy could speak?
Or how many languages Peanuts has been translated?
Oh, hundreds.
Into? Hundreds.
Obviously, all the, I mean, I say hundreds, and that doesn't sound possible, but all the languages we know of, but then I guess it gets translated somewhere we don't know into languages
dialects.
We don't know and dialects, but it would seem as though it couldn't be really hundreds. So it's probably, let's go back and say 20 or 30.
One of the things I was thinking about today as I walked through the museum, and there's that great video in his study upstairs, and the video that shows, I mean, he's just making this line, and
suddenly,
four or five seconds, that's Snoopy. And it's just that I could draw that line, and how did that just spring from his imagination? It was amazing.
Drawing is actually magic, and it's taken me lots of years, and thinking back on Sparky, he drew so quickly that no one would ever think that he put any effort into it. But when you stop to think about it, I mean, now I realize that it's a little bit like us, our handwriting. Mm-hmm. We can write and we can close our eyes and write, but your brain is working as you're writing. And his brain was seeing something and he was putting it on the paper. But drawing is magic, and in a way it's the way music also heals and brings us together, because it comes from the heart, and the drawing comes from it's your brain and your emotion at the same time. But he drew so fast, and that video in that room is wonderful, and it's one of the few times where on that video that Lee Mendelsohn was making a documentary, which never sold. So it never they could never sell it to television. But it's been cannibalized and put in all kinds of different things. So you've seen it before, maybe. But to me, it brought the studio to life. I didn't like to go into the studio.
Mm-hmm.
It just felt cold to me. And then I remembered that piece of video we had. So now,
well, having that video there is just it's so evocative,
yeah.
And it just drew me right in.
And
I liked being there, but then I'd like to see how people work. And I loved the books and seeing the different books on the shelves. But one thing I was thinking about as I watched that line drawing and then looked at a number of the drawings and saw who was there today. There are a lot of Japanese visitors there. And then there's the picture that I'm looking at right now, Snoopy. Even if you didn't see what Lucy was doing, he's clearly just tasted something very sour. And I mean, it's six little lines and it makes a puckered mouth. Well, follow me here because it took me back to a movie I saw in about 1983, I think, called The Makioka Sisters, which unfortunately has never, ever, to my knowledge, been put on DVD. And it was the story of a Japanese family, and the youngest daughter wasn't married, and they were trying to marry her off. But it was visually just breathtaking, beautiful, beautiful kimonos by a very famous kimono designer in Japan. I forget his name right now. But one of the things that struck me about that movie was their gestures, the movement of their head, the way that they would look at each other and agree were counterintuitive with the gestures that we have. Sometimes they would like shake their head. And throughout the movie, I realized that that didn't mean what it meant when we shook our. They weren't saying no. I think they were more in agreement. So that set me for years thinking about body language. And then I thought, okay, body language and then the inflections and the gestures that you get in visuals are different because this clearly appeal, it goes straight to the heart, no matter what your language or culture. Did that make sense?
And
there?
It's going back to the drawing.
To the drawing.
And I think Sparky was the master of that because he could. You could have four panels with Snoopy looking exactly alike. You know, his eye line, and at the end, his eye line would be slightly different. The whole mood would have changed.
He'd change the eyebrow. He'd change the placement of the eye, just like a tiny thing, and would convey such a profound emotion that you were just right there with it.
Yeah, no, Sparky used to always say that one you're talking about with the six lines that are making a puckery mouth, and his ears are frayed too at the same time. But Sparky used to say cartooning is funny drawing, and you have to have funny drawing. To draw you into it, and that's a perfect example. But the drawing has to tell the story.
One of the things that's so interesting about Sparky's life and reading the bits of it that you do see in the museum, his kindergarten teacher told him he would be an artist, and that seems to be what he wanted all along. He wanted to draw cartoons. He created this. He didn't like the word peanuts. Someone else put that.
That's right.
His first editor, I guess, the syndicate chose peanuts. Did he ever adjust to that?
Well, he might have, but he never would have let you know that he did.
Okay.
He always said, it's the worst name in history. And he said, people will think that peanuts is one of the characters. And he's right, because Peanuts has been around 50 years, and just the other day someone said to me something about that and referred to Peanuts as, he said, when Peanuts said something.
Oh, so somebody.
So obviously somebody who is only peripherally knowledgeable about the strip. You know, that's okay, I guess.
Okay. Now, did he originally call it Little People?
Little Folks.
Little Folks, that's
Little
right.
Folks was L-I-apostrophe-L, was a panel cartoon that he drew for the St. Paul Pioneer Press for a little over a year.
Mm-hmm.
And he drew three of them during the week. And they were back in the women's section because they were little kid things.
Little kid things, yes. And Do you think, I mean, he had tremendous success. I mean, he's the most, not only the most famous cartoonist, but the most accomplished, the most beloved.
Probably changed the cartoon more than anyone.
What was his sense of that?
I think that he, more than anything, was always trying to do better. Mm-hmm. Imagine if you're the baseball player who's hitting the home runs. You keep mm-hmm. going. I mean, there's a numerical thing. So you're chasing somebody's mm-hmm. average, somebody's no-hit game, somebody's batting sure. averages, somebody's Wimbledon wins. And I think, I mean, does Billie Jean King was a hero of his, but mm-hmm. does Billie Jean King say, "I'm the best tennis player ever"? No, of course she can't. Not. But she can still be proud of what she did mm-hmm. with what she had.
Absolutely, yeah, sure.
And I think uh-huh. that I think Sparky realistically felt that way. Uh-huh. I mean, I think he was pleased that people like it. He was mm-hmm. proud that people like it. He was proud that he got to 2,000 comic strips. He mm-hmm. was competitive in that way. Mm-hmm. And however many languages it is, obviously it's not important to me. mm-hmm. But I think that he would never have rested on the "I'm the best." Yeah. He would say, "I've done things. I've taken the comic strip in ways that I could take it because of my characters. Other people couldn't." And I think that's a very honest. Uh-huh. I mean, I don't think it's being modest. I think it's being realistic about what you're doing.
Yeah, and I think that if he was someone, I think if he was somebody who sort of rested on, "Oh, look what I've done," the characters might have lost their authenticity, which they never. I mean, one of the remarkable things about Sparky is the characters were always the characters. I mean, Charlie Brown could get that look on his face and you knew he was just the loneliest little boy in the world for that period of time. And there was just, from beginning to end, there was just, I thought, always this remarkable, but the remarkable authenticity and a remarkable zest for life. I mean, what shows more joy than Snoopy throwing his arms back and dancing? Mm-hmm. I mean, to me, that is just the image of what is joyful about being alive.
Yes, I think that even though, you know, people will say Sparky was serious and Sparky was Charlie Brown, but there was also a part of him that could draw that dog with his feet flying as he did his mm-hmm. happy dance.
Yes. He also said something to me once. I don't think we were ever formally introduced.
Oh, I remember meeting you at a party when I was with Sparky.
Okay.
So
okay, and I was back then. I was much too shy to have been able to say very much. But I remember one time at a party at the museum, I was serving food. I was a chef back then, and I had little tiny potatoes topped with creme fraiche and golden caviar. And he picked one up, and he just sort of winced, and he says, "Oh, I just hate to eat them when they're so young." And he said it in such a way, it was dry and
yes,
deadpan
yes.
and so funny. And I just looked at him and I don't think I was able to say anything. I tried to think of something lighthearted and funny to say back. And I just remember standing there and nothing coming out of my mouth. But it was a great moment. And I also used to see you back in the very early days of La Guerre opening. You'd
yes.
be there, and Sparky in his turtleneck.
Were you there? I would often
go there.
A whole
bunch of us would go
yes,
to La Guerre for dinner.
You didn't ever cook there, no.
Oh, no, I never
that was always
there.
The family.
Oh, yeah, no, I didn't. Yeah. No, it was always yeah. the family. No, I would just be there. And I was like, oh, and yeah. sometimes I would see Gay LeBaron yeah. there. I didn't really know anybody yet, but I would recognize people. I think we should take another musical break. And I should tell you, all the songs we're listening to tonight are the same. They are Linus and Lucy, probably the most recognizable of all of the Vince Guaraldi songs from all of the shows.
Isn't that amazing? I mean, it's just
amazing.
Yeah, it just here's a tune that just identifies it immediately.
Yeah, there must have been 100 versions on iTunes, at least 50 different artists today. But when we were walking back to the car after spending quite a lot of time there, and that song was just perfectly loud, and it's just like, oh, it just evokes every bit of it. Yes, it's Mouthful, and that is Vince Guaraldi, who composed or co-composed all of the music for all of the various Peanuts specials, Charlie Brown Christmas, You're a Good Man, Charlie Brown. That particular version is from an album called North Beach, Vince Guaraldi and Friends. Oh. It came out fairly recently. I was just looking through all of the different versions of the song by on iTunes. Every genre.
They're now doing a documentary on Vince Guaraldi's life because, of course, he died quite young.
Uh-huh.
And then other people did the music after he died, did the music for the television shows.
David Benoit, one of them, yes.
But they all sort of stayed with uh-huh. Vince Guaraldi's style.
Uh-huh.
And he was a wonderful, wonderful guy, very shy. But, again, his music was...
Really captured yeah. something.
And everything in his life was in his music.
Uh-huh.
It's wonderful to hear people talk about, people who worked with him talk about him.
Uh-huh.
And Lee Mendelson said, Lee Mendelson is a producer of the mm-hmm. television shows, and Lee said that he would say to Vince Guaraldi, do you want to see some of the animation so that you know what you're writing for? And Vince said, no, just tell me how many yards of music you want.
Music by the yard.
Yeah.
There's a thought.
Yeah.
Well, we don't have that much time left, and we're looking at some of the little cookbooks. Peanuts Cookbook is one of them, and Lawrence Mouthful's engineer here says this was the very first cookbook he bought in 1969, and one of those programs where you can buy books at school, right, Lawrence?
That's right.
And then we have another one here that has been reissued. This is the Peanuts Lunchtime Cookbook. And this was reissued in 2006, but it's a reprint. It's not a revision. So it's still this early and mid-60s
yes.
is what most of the recipes are from. And here I just opened the book randomly. Snoopy's Pizza. Snoopy is dreaming of dinner yet again. So, here's another
Peanut
one.
Peanut brittle. That's the one right
there. That's your
there.
Favorite recipe?
It's so easy. It's something the kid can make, and it's just incredible stuff. You know, you get this reward at the end of the process. It's just like real peanut brittle.
And, you know, that's kind of what cooking's all about, Lawrence. You get this reward at the end of the process.
But as a 9-year-old, you know, it's yes. really magical.
And here's another one, Snoopy holding his mouth, following Lucy. So I think it's sort of fitting that we're going to end with Snoopy and dinner time. For many people, it's just about dinner time. And
Supper time.
That's right. It was supper time.
Supper time. The song from the Broadway play or off Broadway.
Uh huh.
Snoopy was never on Broadway, poor thing.
Well,
he was always off Broadway.
He hasn't been yet. Let's just tell people, what was the inspiration for Snoopy? Who was the inspiration for Snoopy?
Well, Sparky had a very obstreperous dog named Spike that used to attack kids who came to their house. Mm-hmm. And Sparky would laugh as the dog would, just, you know, sort of jump at the door and snarl and scare the kids because, of course, he was a pussycat around mm-hmm. the family. But Sparky used to say that he knew 50 words. So that was the model for Snoopy. But at first, he was just a puppy in the strip.
And if I remember correctly, Spike would show up as Snoopy's cousin.
That's right.
In some of the comic strips. Absolutely.
His brother.
I remember.
From the desert.
Oh, his brother. That's right. I remember
brother
Spike.
Brother from the desert.
And on that note, we are out of time. So, Gene, thank you so much for taking the time. You're making wine. We didn't get a chance to talk about that. If you want more information, and you should, go to just Google Charles Schulz Museum. It'll take you right to the website. You can become a member. You can get the hours. The show, the exhibit, Peanuts Cooks, will be on view at the museum in Santa Rosa through February 15th. Have a great new year. Meet me back here next Sunday evening for another yummy episode of Mouthful, the wine country's most delicious hour.